Early in married life, my husband Kevin and I were in our small kitchen of our first apartment making dinner together. Never one with great spatial intelligence, I turned around with the hot pizza pan that we had just received as a wedding gift and briefly touched the back of his arm with it. He reacted in pain, and I quickly moved the pan. He said a few times how badly it hurt, and I strongly dismissed his feelings. I'm fairly sure that I even said something as tone deaf as, "Don't you think you're exaggerating? How bad could it possibly be? It only lasted a second." Imagine my chagrin the next day when I saw a big scab on the back of his arm. "What happened?" I exclaimed. He looked at me with a half smile on his face and said, "Remember the pizza pan yesterday?" I felt absolutely terrible, both because I had hurt someone I love so much, but perhaps even more so because he had told me his experience and I hadn't believed him. It had taken the unmistakable evidence of an angry red scab, visible with my own eyes, to make me see the truth. That personal story of wounds and not believing connects us to our story from John. Earlier in the chapter we did not read this morning, we learned that Mary Magdalene went to the tomb on the first day of the week and found it empty. She wept, and two angels in white appeared to her, asking the reason for her tears. She explained that her beloved teacher's body was no longer there. And then Jesus himself appeared to her, and when he called her by name, she immediately understood that it was her Lord. And following Jesus' instructions, went and told the disciples what had taken place. Later that same day, Jesus walked into the locked room where the disciples were gathered, saying, "Peace be with you." The text tells us that Jesus immediately and voluntarily showed them the marks of crucifixion, an action that was not shown in his interaction with Mary. Later, Thomas, who was called the twin, showed up, and the disciples recounted what had taken place. Thomas said, "Unless I see the mark of the nails in his hands and I put my hand in his spear wound, I will not believe." A week later, the text tells us, although the doors were again shut, Jesus came and stood among the disciples, and he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Do not persist in unbelief, but believe." And as some translations say, Thomas answered him, saying, "My Lord and my God." Without skipping a beat, Thomas believed and gave thanks with a phrase that many scholars suggest could have heavy meanings, both in a political and religious sense. Calling Jesus Lord could be a crafty way to communicate allegiance to Jesus rather than the empire. And calling him God was something just not done within the religious community at that time. While the other three Gospels tell about people discovering that Jesus' body had left the tomb, and in various ways demonstrate that those people believed in the resurrection of Jesus, this story of Thomas is only found in the Gospel of John. This is not surprising, of course, as John is so dramatically different from the three synoptic gospels. While Matthew, Luke, and Mark record many of the same sayings and stories from their own perspectives, the Gospel of John is simply unique. Written sometime around 80 or 90 of this common era, the Gospel according to John utilizes literary techniques that differ significantly from the others. There is a pronounced use of imagery, such as light and dark, bread and water. The Gospel of John is seemingly more concerned with establishing the divinity of Jesus than the others. The thing is, I don't really understand how Thomas has been characterized by us culturally. Mary believed because she discovered the empty tomb. And then later, as she was weeping in loss, saw Jesus. Simon Peter and the one whom Jesus loved, often assumed to be John the Evangelist in whose name the gospel was written, saw the linen wrappings in the tomb, which had not been unwound from Jesus' body. The other disciples saw Jesus appear, though no doors had been unlocked. And Jesus himself, of his own volition, showed them his wounds so that they would believe. All of these people believed because they had seen proof for themselves, not merely out of the strength of their faith. So it does not seem unusual or even negative to me that Thomas did not believe based on what others had told him. He too wished to see Jesus resurrected with his very own eyes. I can't help thinking that part of the reason he wanted proof was protective. I suspect that Thomas, like the other disciples, experienced profound grief over Jesus' death. And while he wanted to believe that Jesus had been resurrected, he did not want to raise hopes that only would be dashed in the end. While Thomas has been portrayed as a doubter, I think another characterization to consider would be that of grieving Thomas. If I look at this text through the lens of loss and grief, particularly in light of the pandemic that has led to the deaths of nearly a million Americans and millions more worldwide, not to mention the myriad smaller losses we all have known throughout the last 2 years. Thomas's failure to trust the eyes of others does not seem to lack faith, but it seems more like self-protection. And perhaps the only way to maintain mental health in the midst of deep and shattering grief. Yes, the only fitting moniker for this faithful disciple for me right now is grieving Thomas. And as the Reverend Sarah Schmidt Lee said so beautifully from this pulpit last week, the work of grief is, in fact, the work of love. In the past, I have heard others use the words Jesus spoke to Thomas, "You've become a believer because you saw me. Blessed are those who have not seen and have yet come to believe." They've used those words as an indictment against Thomas. However, I don't understand the words that way. Instead, I wonder if it is Jesus' attempt to comfort all of those people like us who do not have the benefit of seeing the risen Christ in bodily form. It seems likely that Jesus knew that a community of faith would form, and that members of that community would not have the benefit of seeing his face or touching his hands inside. Could it be that this was Jesus' way of letting future followers know that we who have not seen Jesus are also blessed? A way of assuring those without any possibility of seeing the bodily resurrection of Christ that they too inherit the Christian message. Jesus built a big tent. And we needn't feel left out. Granted, we are not afforded the opportunity to literally gaze upon the face of Christ. We do not have the opportunity to literally touch his wounds. But as we overhear Jesus through the gospel account, there is an important message here for us too. When Jesus appeared to the disciples within the locked door, he said to them, "Abba, God, as he sent me, so I send you." This made it clear that the death and resurrection of Jesus did not end the disciples' work. Rather, it was only the beginning of what they were called to do, what we indeed are called to do. While the idea of Jesus sending us out could be interpreted in various ways, for me, it has a pretty specific meaning. The Gospel of John portrays Jesus as one who not only fed the 5,000 with 5 loaves and 2 fish, but as one who himself is the bread of life. Jesus is one who not only miraculously turned the water into wine at the wedding in Cana, but has become the living water in the world, for the world. The power of Jesus' incarnation is not simply in his ability to dictate doctrine, but in his attending to the wounds of the world, feeding the hungry, healing the lame, and grieving with the bereaved. While the wounds of Jesus can move us, we cannot touch them. And yet there are many wounds within this world, within our grasp. It just might be that we have been sent by the wounded Christ to address them, to see them, to bind them up. This can seem like a scary prospect, full of unknowns. But as social work researcher and writer Brené Brown has said, "My mom taught us to never look away from people's pain. The lesson was simple. Don't look away. Don't look down. Don't pretend not to see hurt. Look people in the eye. Even when their pain is overwhelming. And when you're in pain, find the people who can look you in the eye. We need to know that we're not alone, especially when we're hurting. This lesson is one of the greatest gifts of my life," she says. A gift of this story from John is the way that Thomas normalizes doubt and uncertainty, especially in the face of loss. While Jesus asked Thomas not to harbor unbelief or doubt, he did not call him a doubter. That moniker seemingly didn't arrive until the creation of a 19th century painting by Karl Bloch called The Doubting Thomas. That's fairly recently in the scheme of things. What we know from the text in John is that Jesus invited Thomas to touch his wounds, just as he had shown the disciples, without request. It seems to me that Jesus asks us to consider the wounds he received at the hands of those working out of power and control and fear, and invites us to touch the wounds of the world that continue because of power and control and fear. We read about and remember the suffering of Christ and are called to attend to the wounds of our own communities and beyond. We read and remember the suffering of Christ and are called not to look away, as Brené Brown's mother taught her. Whether it is the lack of adequate, affordable housing in our own town, the racism that infects every single system around us, the war in Ukraine, The fact that the United Nations estimates that 93% of Afghani citizens do not have enough food to eat. The reality that members of the LGBTQA+ community continue to fight for equity in a heteronormative culture, or any number of weighty concerns that we could consider. In all of these and so much more, Jesus has invited us to touch the wounds and do what we can to tend them. Maybe even heal them. This can look many different ways, involving many different things. Donating money to aid organizations, getting petitions signed, showing up with whatever gifts we have available to us at the given moment. Or maybe it even simply begins by acknowledging our own doubts with transparency, or asking questions that aren't easy to answer. Even imperfect actions rooted in love have the power to change the world. I take enormous comfort in the fact that it is modern humans who call the disciple who wasn't quite sure, doubting Thomas, not Jesus. For me, Jesus' compassionate response normalizes doubt among the faithful, rather than demonizing it. Thomas wasn't sure, and with enormous empathy, Jesus invited him to touch his wounds and try to understand. I have to believe that Jesus invites us to do the same, making room for our questions and our doubt, acknowledging the various trauma experiences that make it hard for us to believe. Scholar and pastor D. Mark Davis puts it this way. But Thomas joins them again. His head and his heart may remain unconvinced, but he joins them. His feet are with them, and they are walking the path again. To me, this may well be why Jesus washed their feet. Because where we walk makes all the difference. There will be times when our head simply cannot wrap itself around the idea that God is making all things new. There will be times when our hearts are not courageous, but discouraged. Even so, we can believe with our feet by walking with the community, letting those who have the capacity to sing the faith sing while we are silent. Letting those who can praise, praise while we can only lament. I tell my own children often, doubt all you want. That is often the path to believing. But the best place to doubt is right here among the church. Thanks be to God. Amen.